Of debates between 1908 and 1911, many in Paris came to agree with Fanchou Trinh's message, French policy will fail unless it is a pro-indigenous one. And the only way Republicans could remain true to their core values was by implementing a workable policy of association with the Vietnamese, including legal guarantees of their individual rights. The result was the decision to dispatch Albert Serrault to serve as Governor General of Indochina with a mandate to implement far-reaching reforms. Born in 1872, Serrault heralded from a powerful Republican newspaper family. His father was a Freemason and militant Republican, a member of the Radical Socialist Party, which was the name of the Republican Party in France at that time, himself. Serrault's ascension in French politics had been meteoric. He voted for the law of 1905 separating church and state and was a committed Dreyfusard. He carried a wound from a duel to prove it. That he had no colonial experience was irrelevant, nor had Dumaire. Also shocked by the events of 1908, the Minister of Colonies, Adolphe Messimy, wanted change. So much so that Messimy and Serrault apparently met with Fanchou Trinh in Paris to discuss the latter's colonial J'accuse of 1907 discussed before. Like many of his socialist counterparts at the time, and this well into the 20th century, Serrault believed deeply in Republican exceptionalism and its colonial mission, convinced that a unique humanism distinguished French colonialism from other inferior types in the past and present. But, like his backers in Paris, Serrault was also a pragmatist. He knew that reform was essential to preventing revolution and preserving the empire, and he was an astute observer of geopolitics. His arrival in Indochina coincided with the rise of Japan and the fall of the Qing in China in late 1911. He closely followed the creation of the Republic of China under Sun Yat-sen. Intelligence reports apprised him of the Asian context in which Vietnamese anti-colonialism and reformism had been circulating. He knew that Fanboy Chow had recently moved to southern China, where he actively sought Chinese Republican support for his Go East Study Abroad program for young Vietnamese to travel to Japan. Serrault was astonished to learn that Mandarins inside and outside the colony were still conceptualizing reform in East Asian, not French, terms. Lastly, the international context also explains this surge in liberal reformism in the Third Republic. In particular, the rise of a colonial-minded Japan, Germany, Britain, and United States convinced Serrault that the Vietnamese had choices. It was no accident that Prince Quang Đệ pointed out in his 1913 letter to Serrault the specific cases of Canada and Australia as models of colonial reform. The French were but one possible partner among several suitors, and Republicans never ceased to justify their continued presence in Indochina by insisting that things would be even worse if others took over. Serrault's worst nightmare was that a war in Europe would end with the Indochinese house in German hands. Fanboy Chow certainly hoped that another Franco-German conflagration in Europe would favorably change power relations in Indochina. Chow met often with German agents in Asia, while Quang Đệ traveled to Berlin, from where he wrote his letter to Serrault. Indeed, the outbreak of war in Europe in 1914 offered Fanboy Chow and Quang Đệ hope. The royal family in Wei also took note. Indeed, in 1916, France's latest colonial emperor, Doi Tan, tried to escape his glass house to join Chow's ranks on the outside. Although the French caught him and exiled him promptly to Reunion Island, Doi Tan's colonial treason made it clear that elite collaboration at the highest level of the protected state was hardly guaranteed. A year later, a prison uprising occurred in Thái Nguyên province and spread to the countryside. It took the French 6 months to re-establish order. Fear, both in official circles and among the settlers, continued to run high. Marius Moutet, a feisty lawyer and the future minister of colonies, had to fight tooth and nail to get his friend Fanchou Trinh out of French prison in 1914. It was in this context that Albert Sereau began implementing a wide range of reforms during his two mandates, which dominated the second decade of the 1900s, 1911-14, 1917-19. Although his overall goal was to preserve French rule, he was sincere in his desire to improve the relationship between the French and the Vietnamese. Upon his arrival, he studied a little Vietnamese under Roux, promoted the first Vietnamese into the European civil service ranks, tried, unsuccessfully, to require French administrators to learn Vietnamese, and made a point of listening to native elite members and treating them as humans. Many such Vietnamese saw reason for hope in Sereau's nomination and gestures. Most of the European settler community, however, worried that this new breed of Republicans, especially these socialist, humanist, and reform-minded governors, would go native on them, as the admirals had, allegedly done, before them, and Pénicaud was doing now. A wall of white silence greeted Sereau when he stepped off the boat in Saigon in 1911. Three goals drove government-backed reforms for Indochina: the elaboration of an official policy of Franco-Annamese collaboration, the introduction of a series of indigenous reforms, and the further rationalization of the colonial state. There was nothing particularly new about any of this. Worried by the Meiji miracle and the rise of Japan, Governor-General Paul Bowe had promoted just such an indigenous policy during his mandate, 1902-8. He had established a modern Franco-Indigenous school system, reformed the Mandarinate, and liberalized the penal code. He introduced a system of consultative chambers in Tonkin for selecting provincial mandarins and created an Indochinese university to produce a French-trained elite class. However, the revolts of 1908 had reversed much of this, as colonial fears had rolled back liberal reform. With strong government backing, Sereau was determined to go forward with the creation of a functioning Indochinese state. He asserted tighter control over the budget, revamped administrative borders, and streamlined the civil service. He presided over the creation in 1917 of the powerful political police, the Sûreté Générale, which was essential to policy formulation, social control, and repression. This went together with the establishment of a rejuvenated Indigenous Affairs Bureau for formulating and applying his liberal native policy. A remarkable group of men, including the head of the political police, Louis Marty, served him faithfully as the governor tried to increase the power of the native elite class by expanding deliberative local councils in Annam Tonkin and opening the Cochin Chinese Colonial Council to more southern Vietnamese. Sereau also promoted some judicial reforms favoring individual and indigenous rights, pushed through fiscal and cadastral changes to lighten the tax burden on the rural poor, and ended rampant concession grants to the European population. He restored the Indochinese university and promoted modern Franco-Indigenous education to resituate elites within the French orbit. Nowhere was the break with the past more evident than in 1919, when Sereau presided over the closing of the centuries-old Confucian exam system. Charismatic and articulate, Sereau was also a master of propaganda. His team promulgated new press laws and authorized the publication of more newspapers, books, and translations in order to promote colonial reform and a Franco-Vietnamese future devoid of its old East Asian ties. Worried by German attempts to turn Asian opinion against the French, Sereau initiated what was for all intents and purposes the start of a concerted Francophonie strategy. Modern photography, cinema, theater, and radio would help win over hearts and minds. However, Sereau also wanted to make good on Phan Chu Trinh's call for more freedom of expression by opening the press to trustworthy members of the indigenous elite. This would provide them with a modern instrument and public forum through which they could express their needs. The press would also allow the colonized to speak out against a settler community that had long dominated the press. Censorship certainly continued under Seurat, but he was often aghast at European behavior and language toward the colonized. Inadvertently, by expanding the colonial press, Seurat also allowed a wide range of colonized subjects, Chinese, Indians, Cambodians, Lao, and Vietnamese, to engage each other in exchanges and shape colonial opinion in new and unforeseen ways. This was the context in which Seurat's team recruited a remarkable group of reform-minded Vietnamese allies and placed them at the head of major government-backed newspapers in southern, central, and northern Vietnam. They included such men as Pham Quynh, in charge of the Nam Phong, Southern Wind, in Tonkin, Nguyen Van Vinh at the Dong Duong Tap Chi, Indochina Review, Trung Bac Tam Van, Northern Central News, and L'Annam Nouveau, New Annam, also in Tonkin, Bui Quang Chu and Nguyen Phu Cai at the La Tribune Indigene, Native Tribune, in Cochin, China, and later Hoing Tuk Kang at the Tiang Dan, Voice of the People, in Annam. Like Phan Chu Trinh, these reformers bet on colonial republicanism, reformism, humanism, and collaboration. Even Phan Boi Chau saw hope in Seurat, leading him to write a pamphlet in 1917 he would later regret, and one which nationalist historians would like to forget, on Franco-Vietnamese collaboration. The title of Cho's essay is significant, because one of the pillars of Seurat's mandate was his ardent desire to enshrine reform in an official policy of collaboration. The governor understood the Vietnamese desire to play a greater role in the administration of their affairs and the country the French had violently taken from them. He also knew that the Vietnamese had supported the French during the First World War and expected a liberal colonial policy in return. In 1919, he delivered a speech in Hanoi to 3,000 Vietnamese elite members before returning to France to become their Minister of Colonies and the Republic's most important colonial thinker since Jules Ferry. In it, he reiterated the French commitment to reform and its unique colonial mission. But he went further, insisting that Indochina had to be more than just an administration. It had to become an operational state, acting for its own interests within the French Empire. Decision-making had to be located in Indochina, not the metropole. Economic development had to benefit the colonized as much as the colonizer. Seurat promised political change. He held out the promise of increased colonial democracy, an Indochinese charter, a federation to hold its different parts together, and eventual self-government. He was fond of repeating that the colonies are states in the making, adding quickly that only a genuine policy of Franco-Vietnamese cooperation could ensure this. Many Vietnamese took Seurat seriously that day, translating and commenting at length on his speech. His plans for building an Indochinese federation with its own decision-making powers, shared with the Vietnamese, convinced many that there was finally a future in working with the French. The French certainly hoped so, as the exhausted Third Republic looked to its empire to help it recover economically from the Great War and remain a great power. It is no accident that Seurat published his colonial treatise on the development of the colonies, La mise en valeur des colonies, in 1923. To put it another way, colonial reformism, development, and federalism did not emerge from the Second World War, but rather in the wake of the 1908 revolts and the First World War. Seurat's vision of a Franco-Vietnamese Indochina was riddled with contradictions, a great deal of naivete, and would fail miserably by the 1940s. But no one at the time knew this, and Indochina was an idea as much as a state with which all Vietnamese would have to contend. Becoming Indochinese? In fact, many Vietnamese took Seurat so seriously that they came remarkably close to rethinking their political future in Indochinese terms. While few in modern Vietnam can imagine such a thing today, it was hardly a far-fetched idea at the time. After all, pre-French Vietnam was the product of centuries of colonial expansion itself. Li Tang Tong and Ming Mang were not only remarkable modernizers and state builders, they and their descendants had also been ambitious colonizers. Moreover, what the Third Republic offered in terms of a special relationship in Indochina was a largely Franco-Vietnamese partnership. The French never offered an alliance to Cambodia or Laos before the Second World War. Convinced that they had to offer something to the Vietnamese in order to obtain their collaboration and thwart Thai expansionism, the French intentionally pushed the Vietnamese elite to remember their own imperial past and to think in Indochinese terms in the present. In 1885, Jules Armand, a leading proponent of association, laid out the premise for promoting a policy of dual colonialism in Indochina at the very moment when he demanded that the court in Wei surrender completely. The day that this race understands that its historical ambitions can, thanks to us, come to fruition in ways that it never before imagined, when the enemies sees our aid allows him to take vengeance for the humiliations and defeats that he has never forgiven his neighbors, when he feels definitely superior to them and sees his domination expand with ours, only then will we be able to consider that the future of French Indochina is truly assured. Lastly, there were practical reasons explaining the French decision to cast Indochina in Franco-Vietnamese terms. Simply put, the colonizers needed local partners to help them operate the Indochinese state on the ground. The Europeans never numbered more than 35,000 during the entire colonial period, unlike the 1 million living in Algeria by 1954, and the Europeans resided overwhelmingly in eastern Indochinese towns. The French had increased Chinese immigration, but most were from the rural poor of southern China, and the last thing the French wanted to do was to import a Chinese elite to help run their colonial state. The French thus trained tens of thousands of overwhelmingly ethnic Viet civil servants, housed them, paid them regularly, and covered their travel costs between Hanoi and Vientiane and Saigon and Phnom Penh, where they worked in the Indochinese colonial administration. In Cambodia, new roads linking Cochin China to Cambodia saw the Viet population grow there from 79,050 in 1911 to 140,220 in 1921. Of the 16 Indochinese bureaucrats working in the town hall of Phnom Penh in 1913, 14 were Viet and 2 Khmer. For similar reasons, the ratio of Viet bureaucrats in Laos increased too. By the early 1930s, the Viet occupied 54% of the posts offered by the administration. This was in spite of the fact that by the late 1930s, the non-Viet populations in Laos constituted 98% of the population. By 1937, this immigration was such that there were 10,200 Viet living in Vientiane, but only 9,000 in Laos. Similar demographics characterized the emerging working class in colonial Indochina. Faced with overpopulation problems in Tonkin and northern Annam, the French began shipping Tonkinese and Annamese laborers to southern Indochina to clear the jungle and to labor on rubber plantations. In the mid-1920s, 3 new roads linking Laos to northern Annam allowed for the easier transportation of Annamese laborers to Thaket and Savannakhet. The overwhelming majority of the workers on rubber plantations in Cambodia and mines in Laos were ethnic Viet. Far from stopping Vietnamese expansion westward, French colonialism often promoted it. The French colonial project thus carried within it a second pre-existing Asian one. While the French may have disrupted the Nguyen civil service of the 19th century, they opened up new possibilities for young Vietnamese graduates in the Western Indochinese bureaucracy in the 20th. These young graduates did not take over the protected royal administration of the Cambodians, but helped run the Indochinese state at federal level as secretaries, customs and security agents, mailmen, clerks, and telegraph operators. Colonial Indochina thus became a functional territorial space, state, and identity for the Viet operating it on the ground. There was one important exception to this Viet occupation and administration, and that was in the highlands, where the French increasingly tried to avoid using them. The formation of the Indochinese Constitutionalist Party under the direction of Bui Quang Chu was one of the first signs that things were running along colonial lines. As editor of the party's official mouthpiece, La Tribune Indigène, and one of France's best allies since Phan Chu Trinh, Chu took Seurat seriously when the latter talked of building an Indochinese federation. The constitutionalists applauded the idea of giving greater autonomy, decentralization, and freedom of action to an Indochinese state, and welcomed the privileged place they would occupy in the colonial alliance. They applauded Seurat's promise of creating a constitutional charter with all the structures needed for a modern state. This transformation was necessary if the colony were to become an autonomous country, and if its Annamese personnel were to become Indochinese citizens. Others took the French Indochinese model and connected it to a colonial Vietnamese past in order to justify continued, indeed accelerated, Vietnamese expansion with the French in the present. In 1921, the Indochinese Constitutionalist Party defended the concordance between Vietnam and Indochina in clear terms. We do not deny these non-Viet races' intrinsic qualities or the right to present their problems within the Indochinese Union. But given the overwhelming majority of the Annamese in this country and the importance of their population, the forces behind their expansion continue. Given the more advanced state of their civilization and, finally, their historic rights, they occupy clearly the most important place in the concerns of the protecting country, France, and her colonizing mission in Indochina. The Annamese are thus first in line for historic, ethnographic, and geographic reasons which would be childish to deny, and against which it would be futile to argue. In Indochina, it's the law of the majority that rules. Within the French Indochinese Union, our supremacy is the logical consequence, the very nature of things. By the 1930s, Vietnamese entrepreneurs and politicians pushed for increased immigration westward in order to take the population pressure off Annam and Tonkin. In an essay entitled From the Annamese Nation to the Indochinese Federation, budding capitalist Phnom Le Bang wrote that in studying the history of the Annamese nation, one also has the impression that Annam is the unachieved history of Indochina. Even leading intellectuals and politicians of the time, not least of all, Pham Khoin and Nguyen Van Vinh, could think of themselves in remarkably Indochinese terms. Part of this shift was designed to force the French to do away with indirect methods of rule, including the monarchy, in order to implement truly republican institutions of an assimilationist kind, even if it meant doing so in Indochinese terms. This is how nations begin to take form in ways we may not expect today, but that did not seem so strange at the time. This is also why it is dangerous to assume that modern Vietnam has always existed in its current form. It could have been, and indeed once had been, something very different. Republican Monarchy, the Birth of the Bao Dai Solution. The French simultaneously pushed in other directions depending on the political stakes. For one, French republicans may have done away with kingship in France, but they had no intention of letting go of their colonial emperors in Hue. Indeed, French republicans considered Vietnamese kingship to be an important part of their policy of indirect rule and association. The French were so taken by Duy Tan's near escape from Hue in 1916, not to mention his father's earlier attempt in 1907, that they decided to mold their own colonial emperor in the form of a little boy named Bao Dai. That Albert Seurat was the architect of this first Bao Dai solution after the First World War should come as no surprise. The governor was only too aware of the dangers of anti-colonialist attempts to turn the Vietnamese monarchy against the French. He was convinced, like his good friend, commissioner to Annam and specialist of ancient Vietnam, Pierre Pasquier, that the Nguyen royal family and mandarinate on which it rested continued to exercise great influence over the majority peasant population. thereby making it a powerful cultural instrument of colonial control and mass participation. Thoreau was no royalist, but like scores of Republicans following in his footsteps, he made major ideological compromises within the Republic's empire in order to keep Vietnam French. And this is why Phan Chu Trinh's dream of overturning the Nguyen monarchy with the help of the Third Republic discussed earlier would be an utter failure. In a letter to Thoreau in 1922, Pasquier privately ridiculed Trinh's idea of creating an enemies republic in association with the French. Anti-communism also explains Thoreau and the French Republic's willingness to think in monarchical terms. Since the October Revolution in Russia in 1917 and the creation of Comintern 2 years later, Thoreau, now Minister of Colonies, carefully watched the Soviet Union's revolutionary moves across the globe and into colonial Asia. Long before American Cold War warriors began speaking of the need to contain Sino-Soviet communism, Thoreau had already called for the creation of a wholly colonial alliance to block the spread of communism into the Western imperial world. In the wake of the First World War, Thoreau and Pasquier went to work to shape a loyal colonial monarch. Knowing that Emperor Cai Din was terminally ill, they convinced him to allow his son to come to them for a modern upbringing. In 1922, Pasquier wrote detailed instructions concerning the raising and education of the young prince. This process had to begin in France, he said, but culminate in Annam. Bao Dai had to be modern, French, and traditional, Annamese, at the same time. To this end, Thoreau and Pasquier took Bao Dai from his family, entrusted him to a French one, and sent him to France, where he was raised and educated in the finest aristocratic fashion. Before sending him off to France, however, Pierre Pasquier reminded the future emperor of his colonial conception and guardianship. "Young prince, always remember the day on which you received the mark of your future destiny. On that day, two grand figures looked down on you, to smile at you, to protect you. Ancient Annam and the sweet and beautiful France, in all of her glory and radiance." Bao Dai spent nearly a decade in France, where Thoreau watched over him. Before returning him to Vietnam to help deal with a new set of revolts, the French had refashioned Bao Dai for colonial purposes, which extended far beyond his native Annam. In an extraordinary mise-en-scene opening the International Colonial Exhibition of 1931, the emperor is dressed in traditional royal dress and plays his traditional exotic part in this well-studied ritual celebrating the empire. Bao Dai sits at the center of the inaugural ceremony of the colonial exhibition in the Permanent Colonial Museum, Musée Permanent des Colonies, built for the occasion and which one can still visit today in Vincennes. The young emperor shares the VIP section with the likes of Marshal Lyautey, while the president of the republic delivers the opening speech. No other colonial emperor or king experienced such an invitation or such a display. Not only did the Nguyen emperor embody the special colonial relationship between France and Vietnam, but at that time he symbolically represented the empire, through the visible intermediary of his person, for the Third Republic. Colonial monarchy is part of modern Vietnamese history, but it is also part of the history of modern France. Bao Dai was the French Third Republic's colonial monarch. This was exactly what the reformists led by Phan Chu Trinh did not want. Chapter 5. The Failure of Colonial Republicanism. On the 1st of January 1929, the leader of the Constitutionalist Party and leading French ally since the First World War, Bui Quang Chu, stepped up to the podium in Calcutta to address the closing session of the Indian Congress Party. Jawaharlal Nehru, the future Prime Minister of Independent India and then General Secretary of the Indian National Congress, had invited Chu and his fellow constitutionalist Duong Van Yao to attend this event. Nehru knew Yao through family connections and earlier meetings in Europe. As Chu adjusted the microphone, the Indian audience welcomed the head of the Constitutionalist Party with hails of "Indo-Chinese! Indo-Chinese!" Chu assured his frenetic audience that the enemies are with you entirely in your struggle against imperialism. "Your liberty is not only an Indian affair," he continued. "It is the concern of all of humanity because you represent a third of the human race. We bring to you, messieurs, the most ardent wishes of the enemy's people for the victory of your noble efforts. Long live India! Long live liberty!" Chu even enjoyed a brief meeting with Mahatma Gandhi, who expressed his support of the enemy's people. Upon returning to Saigon, Bui Quang Chu wrote glowingly of his Calcutta trip in a series of travel notes. He praised the Indian National Congress, the success of colonial democracy in British India, and the model it could provide to republican-minded Vietnamese like him. But Chu's sudden interest in India and Gandhi's non-cooperation with the British struck more than one reader as hypocritical. After all, this was one of France's most faithful followers, a long-time believer in Soro's policy of Franco-Annamese collaboration. A naturalized French citizen, Chu served as vice president of the Cochin Chinese Colonial Council, but had done little to turn it into a more representative Indo-Chinese Congress. Chu disingenuously claimed that he had known nothing about India before leaving Indochina, though his paper, La Tribune Indochinoise, had long covered British reformism and the question of dominion status for India and others. Other Vietnamese most certainly followed events in India attentively, too. In 1926, Phan Boi Chau wrote admiringly of Gandhi's non-cooperation and held it up as a model for the Vietnamese to emulate. Vietnam's most prominent Republican, Nguyen An Ninh, saw in Gandhi's non-cooperation proof that colonial rule, whether British or French, was untenable without the participation of the people. French readers, meanwhile, recoiled at Chu's praise of British colonial democracy, attacking Chu for even suggesting that the British could be better colonizers than they. But for Vietnamese Republicans, the Indian example served as a counterexample to Soro's much-touted but, in the end, empty policy of Franco-Annamese collaboration. Without the institutional reforms on which the Indian Congress turned, it was nothing more than a bluff. Bui Quang Chu knew it, but even after his India trip, he remained on course, unwilling to challenge the French on their failed republicanism, scared, no doubt, to lose his privileges. But this decision would cost him his life in 1945, as Vietnamese nationalists, radicalized by decades of failed colonial reformism as much as international communism, went after and destroyed moderates whom they did not trust. The irony is that many powerful French administrators had themselves never trusted their most faithful collaborators, not Bui Quang Chu, not even their own colonial emperor, Bao Dai. There was no equivalent to Nehru in Vietnam in 1945. There was no Indochinese version of the Indian Congress. There was little real trust within the politics of Franco-Vietnamese collaboration. The Limits of Colonial Democracy. Act 1. The Constitutionalists. Things could have been different. Albert Soro's 1919 promise of a republican-minded contract with the Vietnamese raised the hopes of many that reform was finally going to happen. This was of particular interest to the members of an emerging Vietnamese bourgeois class in Cochin China. This included landowners, entrepreneurs, upward-moving civil servants, and highly educated professionals, doctors, lawyers, and pharmacists. As their economic power and social status grew, so too did their demands for a greater role in decision-making. Most resided in the bustling urban center of Saigon, Cholon. They spoke French, embraced Western culture, sent their children to French high schools, and some enjoyed metropolitan citizenship. Having grown up in Cochin China, they had no direct experience of the Confucian examination system, or the Mandarinate still operating in Annam and Tonkin. In fact, they wanted to abolish what remained of it in the southern countryside in order to introduce a French-style direct administration, which was judged to be more modern. These assimilationist practices were not always crass efforts to mimic the colonizer. Holding metropolitan citizenship allowed these members of the elite to skirt around, via the law, a colonial system which made them second-class citizens in their own country, despite the fact that they were as civilized and as intelligent as the European settlers they crossed in the streets and competed with in placement tests. As in Algeria and Madagascar, French citizenship allowed the natives to participate more effectively in colonial institutions dominated by the minuscule French population. Thanks to metropolitan citizenship, those Vietnamese in Cochin China could own newspapers and avoid censorship more easily. Naturalization could also protect them from arbitrary arrest, unlawful prosecution, and special commissions, as Gilbert Chiu's recent trial had demonstrated. He had supported the anti-colonialist Phan Boi Chau, but avoided jail thanks to his French citizenship. The rise of a bourgeois class is an important milestone in the history of modern Vietnam. This new social group was increasingly interested in capital accumulation and real estate acquisition, the expansion of trade and industry, upward social mobility, and the leisure accompanying it. Few by the 1920s had any interest in reviving the monarchy, despite the Nguyen dynasty's southern roots. Representative politics and expanded access to colonial decision-making attracted them most. Who were they? Some of the best-known names of those in this new and more confident class included Bui Quang Chu, Nguyen Phu Khai, Nguyen Phan Long, and Duong Van Giao. A protege of Pierre Loti, Nguyen Phu Khai had studied in France. A rich landowner, he created the first Vietnamese-owned rice mill in 1915, helped organize a boycott against Chinese traders in 1919, and, as part of this burgeoning economic nationalism, joined in the creation of the country's first Vietnamese bank. Thanks to Soro's support, Khai established the Tribune Indigène in 1917, thereby providing a voice to these southerners determined to work with the French to remake the country, economically and politically. A French citizen, Bui Quang Chu, trained abroad as an agricultural engineer. Upon his return, he rose rapidly in the Indochinese civil service, joined the staff of the Tribune Indigène, and wrote prolifically in favor of republican reformism and the need to accord the Cochin Chinese elite a greater role in colonial governance. Nguyen Phan Long did much the same in his paper, The Echo Annamite, Annamese News, while Duong Van Giao had studied law in France and pushed for increased native representation in colonial institutions. This was not an exclusively southern affair, however. One of modern Vietnam's first capitalists heralded from the north, the indefatigable Bac Thai Boy, rose from rags to riches at the turn of the century, thanks to his shipping and mining businesses. He, too, challenged pre-existing Chinese commercial interests as an emerging Vietnamese business class affirmed itself. These bourgeois elites built on Phan Chu Trinh's reformist project. This included attaining greater freedoms of association, press, and travel, the establishment of the rule of law through judicial reform, and the ending of the colonizers' monopolies upon alcohol and opium. In addition to promoting Western education and commercial modernization, they also sought to expand white-collar careers in the civil service beyond interpreting jobs, to liberalize the requirements for acquiring metropolitan citizenship, and to transform the Nguyen village's own administrative bodies into elected municipalities along French lines. Thanks to more liberal laws afforded by Cochin China's status as a colony and backed by Soro's team, these men created the Indochinese Constitutionalist Party in 1923, the first of its kind in Vietnam. Given their considerable financial support of France during the First World War, through fundraising for it or loans made to it, These Southerners trusted Serow to go forward as Minister of the Colonies in the elaboration of an Indo-Chinese constitution or Congress, which would guarantee expanded colonial democracy. No one had forgotten the Governor-General's historic promise of 1919. We must increase native representation in the existing local assemblies, create native representation in assemblies where it does not yet exist, and enlarge the native electoral body that will designate its representatives in such a way that the native representatives are increasingly the direct emanation of the population and no longer the administration's delegates. This was the foundation of a colonial democracy that many, not just the constitutionalists, could accept. In the southern colony, this meant obtaining increased representation in local municipalities and on the Cochin Chinese Colonial Council in particular. The road leading to such an expansion of political participation, however, was lined with obstacles, not least of all the European settler community. As in Algeria, the French in Indochina were largely opposed to according metropolitan citizenship to members of the native elite or to broadening the native electorate. In the settlers' eyes, the extension of even limited voting rights to the most civilized Vietnamese raised the specter of the native masses running the Europeans out of the colony, legally. The Europeans interpreted any concession to the colonized as a loss. Republican governors certainly pushed through reforms over the heads of such opposition, and a variety of native commissions and representative chambers emerged in Cochin China, Annam, and Tonkin. However, colonial authorities refused the native elite any real decision-making power. The French nominated the so-called native delegates, who only were allowed to hold consultative or advisory roles. They could not vote on budgets or establish quotas for the payment of the corvée, even though the non-European population provided the overwhelming bulk of the tax revenue and labor. In Annam, the monarchy often objected to introducing representative politics, reluctant to lose what little power it still possessed. And when peasants revolted against onerous taxes and corvée requirements, as they had done in 1908, the French backtracked on expanding native representation. The French were not all to blame, however. The constitutionalists never endorsed universal suffrage. In fact, they wanted to limit the native right to vote and French naturalizations to a small social group of elite members like themselves. When the question arose of granting French citizenship to thousands of largely illiterate Vietnamese who had served in France as workers and soldiers during the war, Bùi Quang Chu objected. In fact, the Serow-inspired decree of 1922, expanding the Cochin Chinese electorate from 1,500 to 20,000 individuals, went beyond what the constitutionalists had initially requested. They certainly welcomed this reform as well as its expansion in the number of native seats on the Cochin Chinese Colonial Council from 6 to 10. They threw themselves into local politics, mobilized their papers, and increased the number of constitutionalists on the council. However, they never sought to enfranchise the entire population. They denied the right to vote to women, even those of their own class. On the whole, the Cochin Chinese constitutionalists remained bourgeois reformers, operating from the urban centers and focused primarily on promoting the interests of their class in a delicate balancing act with the settler population and the colonial authorities. Depending on the issues coming before the council and local municipalities on which they sat, the constitutionalists could oppose or support local French politicians. In 1919, for example, many supported Ernest Outre, a trade-oriented settler politician, in his bid to remain Cochin China's deputy to the French National Assembly. Several European traders, editors, and politicians also took sides with the constitutionalists during the boycott of the Chinese, and, depending on the issues, French and constitutionalists might clash when it came to debating important economic matters, such as the Saigon Port Authority, colonial monopolies, and infrastructure development. However, by defining their interests narrowly in urban and class terms, and by betting on French goodwill to implement their desired reforms, the Constitutionalists found themselves in the difficult position of having to prove their faithfulness to the French, and even siding with them in times of trouble for fear of being treated as anti-Français or nationalists. They feared that both labels would undermine their socio-economic status and reformist project. They did. French settler politicians and journalists did their best to keep these Vietnamese in their place and to prevent Sereau's promises from ever coming to fruition. While Sereau and his successors in Indochina were hardly pro-settler, their failure to implement real reforms undermined the Constitutionalists and others betting on colonial republicanism. Fearful of losing control, a string of leftist governors in the 1920s imposed strict regulations on the opening of new secondary schools, closed the Faculty of Law at the University of Hanoi, cracked down on private schools of a modern kind in Annam and Tonkin, and maintained strict censorship and limits on freedom of travel, assembly, and thought. When one of their strongest allies, Pham Koinh, tried to form a political party in Tonkin in 1926, the French refused him the permission to do so. Even the advent of a left-dominated government, the Cartel de Gauche, or Cartel of the Left, 1924-6, in France, and the dispatch of the socialist Alexandre Varenne to run Indochina, did little to expand representative politics. Varenne created the Chamber of People's Representatives, Chambre des Représentants de l'Annam et du Tonkin, for Annam and Tonkin, as well as the Grand Council of Economic Interests, Grand Conseil des Intérêts Économiques. While each allowed its members to voice their opinions and to debate local, mainly economic, issues, both remained strictly advisory bodies and their members could not set their own agendas. Bui Quang Chu traveled to France at this time, confident the change was finally in the making. But he returned home disappointed, especially when he saw what the British were doing in India. This disillusionment was widespread. In 1928, Hoin Thuc Kong, a pro-French reformer who had gone to jail with Phan Chu Trinh during the 1908 peasant revolts, became the president of the Chamber of People's Representatives for Annam. At the outset, he was hopeful that the introduction of colonial democracy to the countryside would bring badly needed change by providing the rural poor with a voice in decision-making and allowing local leaders to bypass the moribund monarchy. In a bitter speech in 1928, he criticized the French for failing to address seriously any of the major pleas coming from the People's Chamber. "Entrusted with the confidence of my constituents, I have assumed, thanks to the civilizing policy of the government, the responsibility of a people's representative for the past 2 years. Yet during the last 2 years, the government has not once given heed to any of our requests, failing thereby to reassure the people that this new institution is different from the absolute rule they had experienced in the past. The people, consequently, have lost their confidence in us. Neither do they believe any longer in the government. We ourselves have often heard uttered by our constituents comments such as the following. The name does make use of the words, representatives of the people, but the reality simply yields a new mandarin it." Irritated, the commissioner of Annam shot back that all was fine, insisting that the people are busily working in total peace. Kong resigned, humiliated and distrustful. In 1946, he would become the president of post-colonial Vietnam's First National Assembly. Significantly, the French never considered expanding their single most important democratic institution in the colony, the Cochin Chinese Colonial Council, northward to establish a pan-Vietnamese or an Indochinese-wide colonial parliament or congress. Until 1949, French Vietnam thus remained a hodgepodge of colonies, protectorates, and military territories. Pham Koinh asked in 1930 whether the French wanted to turn Vietnam into a fully assimilated colony like Algeria, or maintain it as a protectorate by allowing an autonomous Vietnamese state to exist within the French Empire, as they did in Morocco. The French never provided a clear answer, but they systematically refused any attempt to unify Cochinchina, Annam, and Tonkin into one administrative Vietnamese body. Sereau and his successors certainly spoke of creating an Indochinese federation whenever trouble was in the air, but it never occurred before the Second World War in reality. As Boy Quang Chu pointed out in his travel notes of 1929, this was in stark contrast to the Indian National Congress created by the British in 1885. During the interwar years in particular, the British had increasingly allowed Indian elites to organize electoral campaigns, participate in provincial elections, and increasingly partake in colonial decision-making. Some in Indochina may have mocked Gandhi's pacifism, but many Vietnamese understood that this ascetic man and his trusted ally, Nehru, were transforming the Congress from an elitist bourgeois urban party into a mass-based rural organization with provincial committees. Of course, reformism, whether British or French in design, sought to avoid decolonization. However, by failing to develop or allow institutions and mass parties capable of reaching into the countryside, the French left the field open to others while hemming in their most faithful partners all the time. When large-scale revolts broke out again in 1930-31, organized religious, nationalist, and communist parties mobilized along mass lines, while French republicans repressed the indigenous people, reversed reforms, and desperately tried to revive the very monarchy in which so few Vietnamese believed. And by their own refusal to widen politics to the working and peasant classes, the constitutionalists, including Boy Quang Chu, missed a golden opportunity to create a mass party like the Indian nationalists. To young nationalist eyes, the constitutionalists now started to pass for colonial collaborators of the worst kind. Modern bourgeois Vietnamese republicanism was stillborn. The politicization of a new elite, the young. The French, the constitutionalists, and the monarchists alienated another segment of the population, an increasingly politicized and nationalist-minded one by the 1920s, that of the educated young. This new generation heralded overwhelmingly from urban centers, not just Saigon, but also Hanoi, Vinh, Haiphong, and a host of growing provincial and district towns. A few could claim working-class and peasant backgrounds, but most were the privileged sons and daughters of mandarins, civil servants, professionals, and entrepreneurs. Pham Van Dong and Nguyen Thi Minh Khai, future communist leaders, as well as the novelist and nationalist Nhat Linh, all heralded from mandarin families. This younger generation was also the first to experience the Franco-indigenous school system. Many graduated from the much-admired French high schools in Saigon, Chasseloup-le-Bas, and Hanoi, Albert Sereau. By 1925, this French-trained urban intelligentsia counted around 5,000 individuals, doubling to 10,000 a decade later. They worked in the civil service and liberal professions. Many were teachers and journalists. Nguyen Thai Hoc, the founder of the Vietnamese Nationalist Party in 1927, was a schoolteacher, as was Vo Nguyen Giap, who led the Vietnamese to victory in battle over the French at Dien Bien Phu in 1954. A two-pronged linguistic revolution also marked the emergence of this generation as a political force. For the first time in centuries, an entire group of young elite members no longer formally studied Chinese characters, but was now speaking, reading, and writing quite fluently in a new foreign language, French. Unlike the two Fans, young Vietnamese graduates now read Rousseau in the original and discovered and easily understood an array of global ideas in French translation. However, the colonial classrooms also reinforced this generation's mastery of a second written language, their own. From the start, the French pushed the Romanized writing system for Vietnamese in the civil service, schools, and colonial barracks. On the eve of the Second World War, 10% of the Vietnamese population of almost 20 million people could read newspapers in Quoc Nu. Further facilitating the politicization of this new intelligentsia was the introduction of state-of-the-art printing presses, a renaissance in print culture, and improved means of transportation and communications. The number of French and Quoc Nu newspapers, pamphlets, and books in circulation during the interwar period exploded. Despite their efforts to censor Quoc Nu papers and control ideas, the French realized that there was little they could do to put the genie back in the bottle. Sereau may have promoted French and Quoc Nu in the 1910s in order to sever Vietnam membership from China's civilizational orbit, but little did he realize that, within a decade, this script would become a powerful tool for shaping a wide range of local opinions and identities, national, religious, and cultural. A fiery young man who had returned from Paris led the charge. His name was Nguyen An Ninh. Born in Cochin, China in 1900, Ninh was a product of the colonial education system. A graduate of Chasseloup-Louvain, he spoke French beautifully and wrote it elegantly. He translated Rousseau's Social Contract into Quoc Nu. He obtained his undergraduate degree in law in Paris in 1921. He traveled widely in France and Europe and developed a keen interest in politics, nationalism, journalism, philosophy, and religion. Although he fraternized with Phan Chu Trinh in Paris, Ninh shared little of Phan's faith in colonial collaboration. Nguyen An Ninh began to express his doubts publicly upon returning to Saigon in 1922. Armed with a French-language newspaper like none other before it, La Cloche Felie, The Cracked Bell, he wrote a string of hard-hitting articles and incisive essays designed to wake up his generation and to lay bare the glaring contradictions of Republican colonial rule and its twisted discourse for all to see. In 1923, he penned The Ideal of the Annamese Youth, in which he argued that the redemption of the country now depended on the young, both individually and collectively. Most importantly, he insisted, the youth had to act. Life is action, he wrote. To say action is to say effort. To say effort is to say obstacles. And they are many, the obstacles to our ambitions, the greatest of them being ourselves. If the youth could create a new set of ideals, their ideals, then they could create a new culture, a new Vietnam, free of colonial domination and the weight of the past. Sereau's Franco-Vietnamese collaboration and reformist talk was a bluff, he insisted, and the Mission Civilisatrice upon which it rested, a colonial myth designed to legitimate and perpetuate indefinitely foreign rule, for the French would always cast the Vietnamese as children, necessarily incapable of ruling themselves. For Ninh and others like him, the liberation of Vietnam from foreign domination went hand in hand with the unshackling of the individual from what was judged to be a suffocating Confucian tradition. By 1930, young Vietnamese intellectuals were attacking Confucianism and tradition for stifling individual freedoms and thought. As one of Ninh's contemporaries wrote, "It is Confucianism which in the past elevated Vietnam to the rank of civilized nations. It is also Confucianism which has brought Vietnam to the brink of perdition." In other texts, Ninh focused on collective action and the need to develop a national culture in opposition to the colonial one. He zeroed in on the brutality of French conquest, objecting to dismemberment of the country into three parts. He reminded his young readers that the Vietnamese had never lacked heroes. Individual men and women had stood up in the past to resist 1,000 years of Chinese occupation. They could do it again. He resurrected the Trung sisters and their resistance against the Chinese